Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. We are live Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, from Studio M in Los Angeles. I am Stephen Spear, and this is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, the 8th day of October 2022. Reality always wins. We have to have hopes and we have to have dreams. And we must also recognize reality in order to make progress in our lives and in the world. And this is true for today's topic. We're going to talk about primary education, K through 12 learning, its challenges and possible solutions, with a couple of experts who know the subject well and actually have some solid ideas that are really working. Milton Friedman, who won't be a guest today, was a Nobel Prize winning economist, and he said this about our public education system. The tragedy and irony is that a system dedicated to enabling all children to acquire a common language and the values of United States citizenship, to giving all children equal educational opportunity, should in practice exacerbate the stratification of society and provide highly unequal educational opportunity. To talk about our K through 12 education system, its problems and potential solutions, it is my pleasure to welcome two experts in the field to the show today. Robert Enloe, welcome to TalkRadio1.com.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Robert is the president and chief executive officer of Ed Choice, as in education choice. And as we go, we're going to explain what Ed Choice is. Prior to becoming president and CEO of Ed Choice, Robert worked with homeless men and women in the City of London for more than 4 years, and then served as a fundraiser, projects coordinator, vice president, and executive director of Ed Choice. Grant Hewitt, welcome to TalkRadio1.com.
Great to be here, Steve.
Grant is the vice president of foundational education at Stand Together and oversees its vision and community strategy for K through 12 education. Stand Together is an American philanthropic, nonpartisan organization dedicated to bottom-up solutions to societal issues, in this instance, meeting the challenges of K through 12 education. Prior to serving as vice president of foundational education at Stand Together, Grant was the chief of staff for the Nevada State Treasurer's Office. Gentlemen, what's the problem with our public schools? Let's start with Grant, then we'll go to Robert.
Man, Steve, it's a question that we tackle every day. We hear it every day. You know, schools are failing. What's happening? What's going on? And I just want to start by challenging that premise. The idea that schools are failing assumes that schools are not doing what they were established to do, what they were set up to do. And I just think that's a misunderstanding amongst the general populace in America, is that schools are failing because they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, educating kids. When in reality, our public education system was set up during the Industrial Revolution to produce factory workers, to build on for standardization, to create a better way of putting it, a factory model for education. And that's exactly what it's doing today. And right down to the bell that rings to move people between classes, we find that that mimics the factory bell. And so I'm not sure that we can say education, the system, is failing when it's doing exactly what it was set up to do. What I would say is that it's failed to evolve. It's failed to move with the times as society has changed, as the needs of our community and our country have changed. It has stayed static. And so when I think about it's being failing, I think I like to reframe it, and I'm super excited to hear what Robert has to say on this, but I like to reframe it as it hasn't met the needs of its customer as that customer has changed over time.
Yeah, and Gray and I really appreciate hearing that. The idea that the school bell is the factory whistle is something I think really that we should take seriously. So I think public schooling as we know it has, if you're going to use the term, failed because the institutional arrangements around it are set in one era and not for another era. So think about it this way. The schools that we were built in the mid-1800s were built for kids in the mid-1800s, not kids in the 21st century. And if you think about kids in the 21st century, we have the most diverse set of kids of any country in the world almost. We have more complex kids, more complex environments, most complex communities. The system that was created to literally be a monopoly and an institutional arrangement of based on where you live. And so we drew these lines around people's houses and said, hey, if you buy a house, then this is going to be your education. And I don't know if you know this, but I think it's in the 1950s even, and certainly in the 1920s, there were about 130,000 school districts in America. There are now about 13,700. So when you think about the massive centralization of one system that was built in the 1800s and trying to serve a radically diverse set of needs in the 21st century, it's almost impossible for it to achieve whatever its intended purpose was.
So one of the issues is personalization, and I think you said this, Grant, to the customer. Who's the customer? Who should be the customer of education?
No, I think it's a great question. It's one of the things we're tackling at Stand Together is we like to talk about at Stand Together that we are not out to make the system better. We're not out to reform the system. We're out to transform the system. And part of that transformation is ensuring that education has a truly aligned customer. And we believe that that customer is the learner. And that that customer is ultimately, no matter where you are in your learning journey, it is you as the individual or the student. Obviously, in K-12, the role of parents, the role of families, plays an integral part of that learner's journey through K-12 education. But what we see across the country is that that journey and that role of the family and the role of the parent shifts as a child gets older. It's very different in pre-K or kindergarten than it is in 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade. A colleague of mine once talked about, she had a high school he was going into his sophomore year. He was picking his classes for the next year. And he came home and he's like, I picked my classes. And this mother was like, that's great. But like, you didn't ask me. No one asked me what you're taking. And he's like, well, you don't have to. Because the learner's journey had moved to a place where he had the agency within the school to start to select what he wanted to specialize in or learn more about. Well, this was shocking to this mother that like, the bird was leaving the nest, so to speak, in their educational journey. And so we have to respect that through even just K-12, that customer and that journey, it shifts over time to who has the influence points. But ultimately, you know, we believe that the customer is the student or the learner.
So I would probably mirror that, but with a little bit difference and say, I think the customer for us is first of all, the family, and that family writ large. At the beginning stages, it's more parents, and then the late stages, it's more learner. And that's exactly right. And one of the things to go back to your first question, Stephen, is it's the only industry that I know of, K-12 education, that doesn't actually ask the main customer, in this case, families mostly, what the heck they want and need. Let me give you an example of this, like a personal example. So my son was going through high school, and I promise you he did most, as you know, from most of the research, their brains don't start working until around 11:30 in the morning, right? And yet he had to be at school at 7 every morning. It was absolutely bizarre. And if you organized education around his needs, he would have gone to school around 11 and come home around 7, right? It's a different setup if you actually look at it from a customer or from a family's point of need. So for us, I think the idea is family is the main customer. But we also, there is a public good that comes out of education, right? There is. And so society is also a customer, a secondary one. And then, look, educators are also customers, right? So if you look at families, society, and educators, those are the three main components of schooling. And what ends up happening, or learning, not schooling, what ends up happening is you arrange the structure of education around the adults in the system and not the kids in the system.
I think that's
–
Go ahead, Grant. Go ahead.
I think, Robert, that's exactly right. I think this is an opportunity to talk about what's the purpose of education. So we talk about who the customer is. What's the purpose? And this kind of hones in, I think, on your commentary around that there's a secondary audience, that society as a whole is an important piece of this. And so for Stand Together and the work that we do, and I think the work that EdChoice does, since we work so closely together, the purpose of education is that we see is that every individual has the opportunity to discover how their talents and interests can produce value in society so that they can live a life of meaning and purpose and mutual benefit. And so at the end of the day, it's about finding ways and through that personalization or that individualized education, allowing the student through their educational journey to discover, one, what are their interests and what are their passions, but two, how to translate those passions and interests into talents that allow and skills that allow for value creation in our society. And so it's not just out for the pursuit of bliss, so to speak. It's out there to ultimately create some value to society, whether that value is to your community, whether that value is to your employer. So I think there are roles for all sorts of different touch points in education, whether it's employers or community needs, that have to be taken into consideration.
Those of us who are parents know that the very best parents are the ones who make ourselves increasingly unnecessary. We work ourselves out of a job. All of our parenting should be designed to create independent people who are good people, who can clean out their own cage, who can advance toward their goals, who know how to form goals, who have learned how to think and process. And so the idea that the student is the customer of education makes a great deal of sense to me. The idea that the family would be a customer makes a great deal of sense to me. Society, I don't think, is a customer. I think it's a third-party beneficiary, an intended beneficiary, to be sure, but a third-party beneficiary. I wouldn't orient the education system toward society. I would say society will reap the benefits of a good education system. And for the educators, those people are the facilitators. It's the same thing. In my other life, I'm a practicing real estate and business attorney, and my customer is my client, and my client and their goals are the things that matter. Yeah, I'm part of that system, but I'm the provider. I'm the same as a doctor in the medical system as a healthcare provider. And we need to be considered as human beings. We can't be abused. We can't be taken advantage of. We need to make a living. But we're not the customer. So I would argue it's the student and the family that are the customers, the society that's a beneficiary. The educators need to be respected, treated well, properly compensated, and they're not the customer. Argue with me if I'm wrong.
No, Steve, I actually agree with the educators are not the customer per se, but I do think that they're important to remember as the provider of education. And the reason I say that is, in America now, for the first time ever, we have more non-teachers in education than we have teachers, right? And so when I think about educators, I think about the people serving the kids, and they're a different set of customer. They are a provider of a service that should be focused on a family and a learner. But we've got to make sure we take their needs into account because they're also human beings. And at EdChoice, we say we want to advance educational opportunity for all so we can have successful lives and a stronger society. So for us, they kind of go, if you have a successful life, a child who can learn and be on their own, you're going to end up having a stronger society. Quick thing about my son. When they came to live with me, I said five things to him only. Be good people first. Graduate from high school and college. Get a job. Get married and get out of my house, in that order. And if they did so, then they have become productive members of society.
You know, Stephen, this is actually – we can laugh at Robert's commentary, you know, get out of my house. I'm reminded in 2019, prior to the pandemic, some focus groups that an organization with the Stand Together community, Yes, Every Kid, was doing across the country. And I want to tell a story about a dad in Phoenix, Arizona. And this father, I'm going to set the stage. He is excited to be in this focus group. There's 10 people. Of the 10, 8 are mothers and 2 are fathers. So right off the bat, he's outnumbered. And we get to the end of the focus group, and we've a number of questions like reinvent the school. Like, what would a high school look to you if you had to reinvent what a school would look like? And you got everything from you probably couldn't tell a junior college from a high school anymore. It would be outside. It wouldn't have walls. But we asked a final question. The question was, how will you know as a parent that your child got a successful education? And this for me was an incredibly eye-opening moment even in my personal journey of understanding transformation of education. And 9 people went ahead of this dad. He was the last one to take the microphone. And we heard everything from SAT scores to GPAs to college admissions, almost every standard metric you would hit. And then there was dramatic pause from this dad. And he said, I'm glad this is the last question because I'm going to be thrown out of the circle. And he said, his answer was his purest view of how he knows his child got an education. And it was, and he paused and he goes, that they're no longer living on my couch. That was success. And he went on to say, look, you know, that could mean they got into college, they're living in a dorm room. That could mean they married their high school sweetheart, had a job, and have an apartment somewhere else in town or maybe in another town. They could have joined a Mormon mission. They could have gone to the military. He's like, but all of these factors have one thing in common. They're no longer at home. And he said, the education has prepared my child for life after the home, after the nest, is what a good education is. And that's how I'll know he got one. And, you know, I just sat back and I was like, wow, that was really different. Like, that was bold. I was ready for SAT scores. And so it actually really influenced the work that Stand Together is doing, because it was a moment of transformation for our organization to sit back and go, wow, we're really not trying to make it better. We're really trying to do something different. And so if we are out working to improve SAT scores, we are missing the boat, because that's not what, I mean, that may be the common measure, but it's not what people or the customer, in this case, the family or the learner, is really looking at. They're looking at it because someone else has told them it's important, not because it is actually important to them. And it was really eye-opening to just see this level of candor that we saw in 2019 go just, you know, obviously at that time, a year before we knew the pandemic was going to happen.
There is a lady who I've seen and met in person several times over the decades. She is with the Los Angeles Unified School District Board of Education, and she's been there for decades. And she's a fine person who believes strongly, passionately in education and free speech and so forth. And she is also a creature of the Los Angeles Unified School District. And when our kids were little, I went and met with her, and she spoke to a group of us. And she was explaining that the reason that the Los Angeles Unified School District, one of the largest school districts in the country, is a good idea is because she said, I can send 35 school buses to one spot, and I have these massive assets that I can do, and I can run in the same way every classroom in the Los Angeles Unified School District. I can have uniformity, and therefore I can have equality, and therefore I can have equity. It was something just like this, and that was her view. I think that dovetails with your view of a factory model with bells.
Yeah. In fact, I would say but unfortunately, we would probably take the opposite side of that argument and say that what she's talking about doesn't get you to equality or equity. When you create that kind of uniformity and don't really care about the individual needs of individual customers, you're never going to get to it. Milton Friedman once said, a society that puts equality above freedom gets neither, that puts freedom above equality gets a large measure of both. And this concept of providing customer-oriented service, providing a individualized, personalized education that meets the child learner where they are and allows them to grow in the ways that work best for them, whether that be in a school building or out of a school building, or in ways we haven't thought of. I think when you talk about this kind of uniformity where every kid is taught in the same way in every grade, in every measure, that just creates a move to the middle at the very best, right? At the worst, it creates a hodgepodge of very poorly run schools.
I couldn't agree more. And I think what it is it's a lack of dignity and respect for the individual learner. And if you've met two kids, even two siblings, or if you've met a classroom of kids, there is absolutely no way that you can say with a straight face that all of these kids are the same or all of these kids learn the same. But yet what the system has tried to do, again, because that's how it was set up to operate, is to create this uniformity and to teach to the average kid, which I've yet to meet an average child. And so what I always say is a one-size-fits-all system is like a one-size-fits-all hat. It fits nobody. And so why do we continue to push down this idea that the solution has to be a one-size-fits-all approach? What I think we should be driving for, and what I think parents, one of our key customers and one of the key influencers in a learner's life, are looking for is a educational opportunity that meets their value set, that respects the dignity of their learner and the individuality of their learner, that allows their learner the opportunity to discover things. And so they're not looking for better anymore. And I think that's different. So I actually think pre-pandemic, parents were looking for better. They were sitting around going, how do I get a better delivery? How do I get a better test score? How do I get a better accountability model? How do I get better assessments? The pandemic changed everything. And so now, I mean, we've seen studies that show 70% of parents in this country want something different. Steve, go ahead.
Two things are true. First, all people are created equal. And two, I've never met two equal people in my life. Every one of us, just like everyone else, is an individual. We have individual needs. Your comments, Grant, with regard to the pandemic, bring me to a piece by Sean Hubler. And I'm going to read just a piece of it so we can talk about what the pandemic did specifically. The pandemic has supercharged the decline in the nation's public school system in ways that experts say will not easily be reversed. Orange County, California, this story comes from the New York Times. Again, Sean Hubler reporting. In New York City, the nation's largest school district has lost some 50,000 students over the past 2 years. In Michigan, enrollment remains more than 50,000 below the pre-pandemic levels, from big cities to rural Upper Peninsula. In the suburbs of Orange County, California, where families have moved for generations to be part of the public school system, enrollment slid for the second consecutive year statewide. More than 250,000 public school students have dropped from the California rolls since 2019. And since school funding is tied to enrollment, cities that have lost many students, including Denver, Albuquerque, and Oakland, are now considering combining classrooms, laying off teachers, or shutting down entire schools. Altogether, America's public schools have lost at least 1.2 million students since 2020, according to a recently published national survey. State enrollment figures show no signs of rebound to the previous national levels anytime soon. A broad decline was already underway in the nation's public school system as rates of birth and immigration have fallen, particularly in cities. But the coronavirus crisis supercharged that drop in ways that experts say will not be easily reversed.
This is real. One in six families during the pandemic changed the educational delivery model of their child. 25% of California families chose something other than the traditional public schools. And a recent Titan Partners survey of American parents indicates that a decrease of 9% in public school selection. That's over 4 million students is the numbers that are being reported. What is scary is the numbers being reported by families don't necessarily always match the numbers being reported by the system. So there is some funny math going on somewhere. And there's a reason for that funny math to be happening, because so many school districts are tied to enrollment as the way to get their funding. To admit what is happening is terrifying. It's a very scary proposition for these folks. But I think what we're seeing is an awakening of families to just how disconnected that factory model was to what their learners need, what their value sets were. And so they're just taking back the reins of control. And what I like to tell a story about a mom in Las Vegas, Nevada. This mother, previous to the pandemic, she will sheepishly say, but I think a lot of people listening can relate to this, she would say she thought her role in her child's education was to get them there on time. That was her duty.
Wow.
Did they make the first bell? And I've heard it over and over. I was in West Virginia just earlier this week talking to activists there around educational freedom. And they, when I made that comment, when I told this story, they nodded. They were like, oh, yeah, I could totally see it. Absolutely. And this mom had the pandemic happen. A reminder, the fifth largest school district is in Clark County, Nevada. It closed for a better part of 6 to 9 months, attempted to reopen, closed in, created a ton of disruption here. And this mom was like, for the first time, I now own my child's education. And she attempted to set up a micro school with 8 other families in her living room to help them get through this time. They selected tutors and teachers to help them. But she realized that wasn't the solution for her kids, for all of her kids. She had 4. But coming out of the pandemic, she's realized that, one, she's an active player in her child's education. Like, she matters more than making sure they get there on time. She's also recognized that all 4 kids are going to probably have 4 different learning environments. And she's met that need. She now has two of her children thriving in a micro school environment that has less than 50 kids in it. She's got 1 in a traditional charter school, and she's got 1 in a traditional private school. And so, you know, this mom went from everybody's getting to the same bell in the same door to an awakening and to a new way of doing business. And it's been eye-opening. So I think but this is what parents are experiencing across the country.
And they did. When the schools closed and they stayed closed, and frankly, I think a lot of traditional school districts botched the way they dealt with that, families began to see and take power back for themselves. And I think of Bernita Bradley in Detroit, Engage Detroit. So Bernita Bradley, Steve, she's a black mother who her daughter wasn't being served. She had tried the public school system. She tried to go back, and she just said, my daughter is not getting what she needs. So the pandemic comes along. She starts homeschooling her kids, and then realizes what she really needs to do is teach other black mothers how to homeschool. And so she creates this community organization around empowering families to own and run their own education. And I think that's why you're seeing numbers. EdChoice does monthly polling, and that's why you're seeing numbers like 71% of public school parents and all parents want dollars to follow the kids wherever they go. There's a great desire now to have funding follow families to whatever setting that they go to, and not just to traditional school settings. And the way we fund schools is so ancient and not modern, right? And just think about it this way, Steve. When a child, one of the arguments you'll get against educational freedom writ large is you're going to take money away from public schools, right? I make the argument is, well, any child moving from one public school to another public school does the same thing, right? And so it's actually not really a question about whether you're taking money away from public schools. You're actually taking money away from a system and not letting parents have the power in it. And so what the pandemic did, Steve, I think, is really changed the nature of how parents want to have that power, and they don't want the system to have that power, particularly over the money.
So one of the things that has become clear in the first 30 minutes of today's program is what the problem is. And if I were to describe it from my perspective, it would be that it's a top-down solution. It's the idea that a small group of experts will decide what children's education should be. When I say small, I mean not the millions, the hundreds of millions of adults in the country, not the tens and tens of millions of parents of elementary school children, but a much smaller group of people who perhaps have a degree in education, perhaps have a master's degree, perhaps have studied and have erudition in education. So you could truly call them experts, but that group decides, and they decide within an existing structure. And instead, what we're going to talk about, what we'll discuss now about EdChoice as in education choice, is a bottom-up approach, a very different approach. Right now, the best school choice that most people have is where they choose to live. So if you're going to buy a house or if you're going to rent an apartment, every realtor knows this. The first question that parents with children or people who are going to have children ask is, what's the school district like? And there are people who gravitate specifically toward a specific school district in their area because they know that school district is better than another school district. And this is whether they're buying a house or renting an apartment or renting a house. It's something that parents are very conscious of, and it is the only choice they have, is how to pick where you live so you're in the right school district. So this brings us to EdChoice. What is EdChoice? What is school choice? Lay the groundwork for us.
So let me start with that one. So educational choice is the idea that a learner or a family can truly control the education of their children, whether that, and that first of all, that's control the location. Second of all, is control the money and have the opportunity to choose, right? So, and in fact, not just choose one school over another. This is actually the ability to choose a whole set of different options and customize, right? So it's the freedom to do everything. And so the idea of educational choice is that all families get all dollars to go to all learning opportunities, current and the ones we haven't even thought of. And they could be any form. I mean, Milton Friedman thought of the idea of a voucher. Right now, he would say, well, voucher's old school, right? He would say things like education savings accounts. He would say things like, how do we get more direct dollars to kids? How do we unbundle the funding for transportation and give it to children and give it to families instead of going through school districts? How do we give microgrants? How do we do any kind of way to fund families and modernize the funding system? So I think educational choice is basically truly empowering all families with all dollars to go to all school types on all learning opportunities.
And I think it's important. Robert hones in on that finance piece, which is really an important piece of the puzzle. But he also talked about, but didn't really dive full into the deep end of the pool. But it is around educational freedom as a whole.
Right.
And so I think when we've talked about EdChoice or school choice, most people have viewed that as the choice of where the learning happens. Mm-hmm. So which seat are you in? Are you in a public school seat, a charter school seat, a traditional private school seat? And while that, I think, is the battle that has been waging amongst ed reformers for the last 26, 27 years, I think where we find ourselves today is in a new space. It's a new opportunity to define that to be even broader. So it's not just where you learn, it's what you learn, it's how you learn it, it's where, when you learn it, and by whom it's delivered. And so I think educational, we're seeing a shift in language. And a lot of times when you see a shift in language, you realize that that's because the culture is shifting along with it. And so, you know, over the last 24 months, we have seen a dramatic shift from framing of choice as being just where to educational freedom. And it's about where, when, how, by whom, and what.
So this
is really shifting.
This is a mind-bending concept, and it took me a while to understand it. But it is so different than the idea of a school district with bells. It is the idea that there it's a free form, and it could be outdoors, indoors. It could be. Let me just read the list from edchoice.org, edchoice.org, of the different school choices that people might have. I'll be brief. Here it is. School vouchers, tax credit education savings accounts, tax credit scholarships, individual tax credits and deductions, charter schools, magnet schools, inter and intra-district public school choice, homeschooling, hybrid homeschooling, online learning, micro-schooling, town tuitioning, personalized learning and learning pods. I'm going to stop there, but the list goes on. And what is the most important thing that we need to grasp, and let me start with you, Robert, to understand just how different this approach is?
To understand how different it is, you have to sort of really break apart the concept of what you think school is, right? Because, and go to what the idea of learning is. So where learning takes place anywhere, at any time, in any location, and how you learn is different. My child, for example, didn't really need to go to a senior year in high school. He could have learned on YouTube. In fact, he says he learned more on YouTube the first year of college too. You know, how he learned was a different medium. What he learned, right? How he can customize what he learned. You're really unbundling the whole concept of an 8-to-5 or 8-to-6 school and really starting to think about what does learning mean in the 21st century and how you do that and when you do that and what you do that with and all the other models. It's a true, and I hate to use this word, it ultimately ends up being a true marketplace of opportunities, right? And it's not delivered by one mechanism or even multiple mechanisms. I say this all the time about the reason why this blows your mind. If you think of our current system of private schools and charter schools, right, they only exist because basically they're the only ones allowed to exist in a monopoly format, right, the way we look at society. So if I were to say to you, Milton used to say to me all the time, Stephen, imagine all of a sudden we make every single hot dog vendor on every single corner in New York City free at the point of delivery. It's publicly paid for. It's free. You have to go there, and you're assigned based on where you live. He's like, what would happen to all the other hot dog vendors? He said the only ones that would exist would be the high class upper class ones in the Upper West Side, and the kosher hot dog stands. That's not truly a marketplace. What we're really thinking about, what's mind bending about what we're doing now, is we're really shifting the concept from schooling to learning, and really unbundling when and where and how that happens.
So this is not just a theory. You're actually doing this. Explain edchoice.org.
Yeah,
explain what's happening. Where are we now? What's the plan? How far have you gotten?
Well, I mean, we've gotten so far in so many things. I can't wait to hear Grant talk about this too. But you know, we've gone from a situation where we're fighting for a school voucher program 10 years ago in Indiana to we now have every single student in the state of Arizona and nearly every single student in the state of West Virginia can basically take their dollars and customize them. They can go to a public school, private school, charter school, homeschool, online. They can actually mix that all up. You've got micro grants coming in and letting parents buy the ability to purchase courses online from OutSchool and all these different things. You've got micro schools being created all over the country with Prenda and with Andrew Newman and Open Sky and with the National Micro School Academies, the group that Don Soifer is putting together. Heck, in where Grant lives in North Las Vegas, their entire system is basically run on micro schooling. So this concept is really happening all over the country. And what is it? What's it's doing? It's really giving power back to the hands of the individual parents and consumers to sort of build their own system, construct it the way that works best for their kids.
Yeah, I'm just going to echo everything that Robert said. There are a couple things that I really want to hone in on. One, innovation is happening within public schools. They are right. Figuring out different ways to do this. They are looking at partnerships with private entities. They are looking at ways to provide more experiential learning to happen to kind of break down the walls. I think of a charter school in South Bend, Indiana, Career Connections Academy. It's an amazing place where kids are going half the day learning core material and then half the day learning hands-on career-driven opportunities. And these opportunities are happening all over the country, and it's happening under everybody's nose. There are two examples that Robert just mentioned that I think are super interesting to talk about. And what he said, West Virginia, and he said Arizona. And these are the places where we have seen the purest opportunity for money to follow the child wherever they wish to go. But both have one unique thing in common. You can use that money as a parent to buy services or classes back from your public school, which takes away this zero-sum game that you have to pick one delivery model over the other delivery model. So let's say you wanted to do half of your day learning in an experiential opportunity, but you didn't feel real comfortable with organic chem. As a parent, or you didn't see a place for that, or maybe to learn Chinese or Mandarin, you can buy that back, or you could buy it from a different provider. So you can create a really customizable opportunity. The reason I focus on these two states is about two numbers. One, in Arizona, 100% is the number that I like to talk about, and that number means that every family in the state of Arizona has the freedom to make the decision. They have the freedom to be an active consumer of their educational delivery and process. In the state of West Virginia, it's 93% of families, and it has the opportunity to be 100% of families in the next 5 years. And so the reality is that in these places, we have the opportunity for markets to develop. And I know if we looked back 10 or 15 years, we wouldn't have thought about education as being a market-driven system. But in these areas where we're seeing this movement happen, we're starting to see marketplaces develop. And so what I think is really happening culturally in this country is that education is moving from a service that is provided to a consumable product where the user and the customer are active participants in that process, that there is not just one way to do this. And so Arizona culturally is a lot further along than maybe a state like West Virginia, because over the last 20 years, they've had robust open enrollment policies in Arizona within the public system. Arizona is one of the few places in the country that you can go to Phoenix or Tempe or anywhere across the state. And during a certain period of time in the year where it's open enrollment for public schools, you will see public high schools recruiting kids from all over the city. My school's best at history. We have the best robotics class. Come here to learn aeronautics. That consumerism that's developing in education is super exciting. Now you couple it with the dollars, the opportunity to have the dollars to move around, and it could be game changing to the marketplace.
So let's take the other side for a minute, because some people look at this and look at, I'll broadly call school vouchers and all school choice, And you touched on this earlier, that they say it'll take money away from the schools. And what will happen is that the best and brightest kids with the parents who are active in this will remove their children from public schools. They'll take them to private schools. And the result will be that public schools will be even worse. They'll be even more poorly funded. They'll be even worse in achieving the goals of helping children actually learn. And the people who will then suffer will be the poor and minorities, and it will all be terrible.
See, so I hear this. I've heard this for 26 years now, right? And I gave testimony last year to the Indiana State Senate, and I literally was the last one to go after a four-hour hearing. I said, you guys, you have heard the same exact argument for 26 years, and not a single one of them have come true. Let me say what I mean. Who's going to leave their school or their educational system? Someone who's thrilled and happy with what's going on with their kid and their education, or someone who's actually concerned? Someone who's actually not getting served? Maybe someone who's getting bullied. Maybe someone who has special needs that are different. Maybe someone whose child is not being educated in a culturally appropriate way. There's all sorts of reasons why families will leave. The reasons they're leaving, though, are not because they're super happy. So typically what ends up happening, children who've been mostly underserved by the traditional school systems, frankly, public or private or charter, have been children of color who are poor. Right? They're the ones who, if you look at the numbers and data, vastly are the ones choosing educational options. There's a reason why homeschooling during the pandemic, the fastest increase was among Black single mothers, 30% increase in the use of homeschooling among Black families. Why? Because they know their kids are not getting served in the way they want them to get served, right? So we know that the data shows that families who are choosing or families who are opting are typically the families who are unhappy for whatever reason they may be, right? And actually getting more served better in their different options. So we know that's not the case. Now, there's a legit issue here for traditional schools going forward, and that is this. Every single state is going – we are declining in school-age population. Every single state is declining. And during the same time in the last 25 years, public school costs and expenditures have dramatically outpaced inflation, right? They spend more money than anyone else, right? That's why we have more non-teachers than teachers. So there is a coming question that's going to be called, because there's going to be greater competition among this fewer population, right? So there's going to be less kids and more options, and that's going to create a challenge for them. But they can handle that because traditional schools have handled that forever, right? So they're going to have to come up with creative, innovative, market-driven ways to figure it out. But we do know, the evidence shows, the kids who are being served by school choice are the ones that actually feel that they're not being well-served in the current structure they're in.
And Stephen, I would point out the conversation we literally just had around that school choice exists prior to this revolution that's happening. It existed with people where you lived, like where you chose to live. And so for a lot of families who are saying that the wealthy will just pull their kids out, they will do something different, they've already exercised their choice. They've already gone to where they want to go. So I would point to a state like Oklahoma, which 2 years ago passed, for the first time in Oklahoma, they passed a robust open enrollment policies within public schools to allow kids to move with ease both inside a district and outside district lines between schools. In 2 years, we've seen 11,000 families step up to the plate to operationalize in that program. When prior to that, it was just a handful that took availability of the laws that existed on the books in the state of Oklahoma. And so, people are moving, they are making the choice within the public system. Then when you couple it in to the dollars to this equation, it just creates more freedom and more agency. It's why I focused on the numbers 93% in West Virginia and 100% in Arizona, because we're not prescribing, myself at Stand Together or Ed Choice, no one is prescribing that they know what the right delivery model is for a child. What we are saying is that you should have the agency as a family and as a learner to operationalize something different if you so choose to do so. And so that's a really important piece here, is that we're not saying that, you know, public schools are awful for every kid. We are saying that they are not meeting the needs of certain kids, and those certain kids are going to move to do something different. And we do see, as Robert pointed out, this explosion in non-traditional learning environments with single Black mothers driving this change. We've seen it in Arizona. We're seeing it in other places in the country. All of that is true. One of the things that I think people fail to appreciate or realize is that the cost to do something different isn't what we think it is,
right,
and it isn't what it was 5 years ago. So I was talking recently with the head of the Vela Education Fund, Meredith Olson, and Meredith was talking to us about this explosion in a new price point for for unconventional learning models. So back in the day, a traditional private school, even today, high-end traditional private schools are running like $30,000. And in some places, I'm being generous with that number. I'm being conservative. At now, and when they were that expensive, families were like, oh, I just can't even think about that number. Like, that's not even remotely obtainable. So they didn't even look. And so they were stuck. Now, after the pandemic, because of technology, the explosion of micro schools, the explosion of unconventional ways to teach kids, that price point, there's new price points in the market at $5,000, at $4,000, at $2,000. There's price points that are, you know, some cash and then some, you know, volunteer working to make the environment work. And this has changed the game completely. Because from a basic economic perspective, you now have an entirely new customer base who was turned off by the $30,000, but now is like, well, I could donate like 10 hours a week and I could do $3,000. Like, I could make that happen. And that now is obtainable. And so we now have a whole new level of customer who's looking to do something different. And the economics have totally changed. Robert?
And let me just quickly jump in, Stephen, on this one. If you think this is going to stop, that's not going to happen. Because you know who likes to customize? Millennials and Gen Zs and the next ones, right? The customization is happening, and that's what they want in the future. And the future looks so much more like what Grant is talking about in terms of price points and customization and how it gets delivered. You know, again, let's say one of our favorite poll questions we ask in our poll is would you be okay with your child being educated at home or somewhere else outside of a school in a week? More than half the families now tell us, and this has been consistent for well over a year, would they be okay with their children out of school for one day or more? About 50% say 2 days is fine with them. Like, the numbers of families who are saying we want something different delivered in a different way, where they can spend $100 on an out-school course and get a high-quality course provided by a high-quality educator that's going to give them the same learning they would get for 2 weeks of schooling – parents are going to say, hey, that's a much more efficient model for me.
It seems, and I just want to leave, you know, I love statistics. I love studies. The Titan Partners research that was released just last week indicates that of young families, they are 20% more likely to select an unconventional learning model in the next 3 years. So the younger the parents, the more likely and more open they are to this concept. The other thing is that if we're able to bring awareness of unconventional models and individualized opportunities and increase that level of awareness by just 10 percentage points, families are 40% more likely to select something different. And I think that's just an incredibly eye-opening number to say, wow, you just have to become slightly, just a little bit more aware, and your openness to doing something different shifts. I'll leave you with this thing, this comment, that what the pandemic really did was, one, for the first time in American history, we have a group, a demographic group who all felt the exact same moment and the exact same pain point, no matter where they are in the country. If you're in Bangor, Maine, or you're in San Diego, California, or Kalispell, Montana, or Wichita, Kansas, schools closed for two weeks plus across this country. This created a level of openness and trust amongst those parents that we had never seen before. And one of the major revelations coming out of the pandemic is that what I like to refer to as parent-on-parent violence, the judginess of parents pre-pandemic to say, what is good for my kid must be good for all kids, or if you're doing something different, your kid is weird. And we all know it. We've all said it. Man, those homeschool families are just a little weird. Like, that changed. And now what we see is families who all experience the same thing at the same time are saying, what's good for my kid may not be great for your kid, but you should have the right or the opportunity to do what's best for your child. The zero-sum game, the false choice no longer exists amongst families. They respect each other to a higher degree than ever before. They trust each other because they've gone through this common experience, and they are now open to an entirely new process to educate their children.
And they are comparing notes. They are comparing notes with one another. What they're doing is they're taking a look and saying, what are you doing? What am I doing? Here's what I'm doing. What are you doing? And this is what parents have always done when they're talking about child behavior and child rearing and decisions they make. But they never really did it with school because school was extrinsic. It was being handled by the school. And so there was nothing really to discuss except where you picked to live so you'd be in the right school district. So the difference here is a collaborative effort among parents. So it is customer is the child and the learner, and the parents and the family, the entire family unit, are the customers, and they are helping each other compare, comparison shop, if you will, just as they would to figure out where the best restaurant is or what movie they should see.
The Republic of Science is alive and well in education, whether it's with the entrepreneurs who are doing it differently, talking to each other, leaning on each other, finding new and alternative ways. One of the things that I live in Las Vegas, Nevada. One of the things I've witnessed is that these little unconventional learning environments do not consider each other competitors. They consider each other an ecosystem, and what they do at their school may not be right for every kid. They're not trying to find the solution for every kid. They're pointing kids to other providers. It's amazing the level of openness we're seeing with families and with providers.
Open market competition. How about that? So I think one of the biggest objections that people have when they say that it leaves behind the underprivileged, the poor, the minorities, when they say that, this is, I believe, a belief on their part that people need to be taken care of from the top down, that people need a group of experts. And I'm not disparaging experts. We all need to get expert advice. Experts are real. And if they know their stuff, they are experts. They should be consulted, but they shouldn't be in charge. They should be consulted. So when I go to my doctor, I'm going to pay attention to my doctor. I'm going to listen to my doctor. And then I'm going to make my own decisions. I'm going to decide how much bacon to eat or how much broccoli to eat. After I learn from a nutritionist what to do, I'm going to make my own decisions. And the soft bigotry of low expectations suggests that you can't leave it to parents to decide what to do with their children, because so many parents are so ill-equipped that they need to be told what to do. Having said that, let me leave a final word to you, Robert, then a final word to you, Grant. Robert.
I'm just going to be very short. Everything we've just talked about today is to trust parents to do what's best for their children. I trust parents, and I think if we organize education around trusting the learner and the parents, it's going to continue to be more dynamic. And that's where we're going right now with this incredible dynamic educational choice environment.
That is Robert Enlow, the president and CEO of edchoice.org, which, Robert, 501c3, all donations are completely deductible?
Absolutely, yes, sir.
Grant?
Yeah, the I would leave you with exactly what Robert said. Believe in people, believe in families. Shed the idea that one size can fit all, that standardization is important. We need to continue to drive for openness, pluralism of providers, and an openness to multiple outcomes when it comes to education. Let's redefine the purpose of education about creating value in society, about allowing kids to discover what their passions are and learn how their talents and passions can provide value.
That is Grant Hewitt.
It's a great day.
That is Grant Hewitt, the Vice President of Foundational Education at Stand Together. StandTogether.org, StandTogether.org is also a 501c3 charitable organization, which is an American philanthropic nonpartisan organization dedicated to bottom-up, so not top-down, bottom-up solutions to societal issues. The alignment in principles between EdChoice and Stand Together on these issues of education is seamless. Robert Enlow, thank you so much for being with me today here on TalkRadio1.com.
Thanks for having me, Stephen.
And Grant Hewitt, thank you so much for exactly the same being with me here today on the program.
Thank you, Stephen. It was fun.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guests have been Grant Hewitt and Robert Enlow. Take a look at the website edchoice.org, edchoice.org. You'll see all sorts of things about school choice, the background, how you can engage, how you can learn about this for your own children, for your own choices. And for those of you who are parents, boy, is this an empowering thing to look at. This is something that can help you engage in the healthiest possible way in your children's education. If you are a grandparent or if you know a parent, send them a link to this show, have them listen, and have them take a look at edchoice.org. My next show will be 1 week from today. No, it won't. It will be 2 weeks from today. My guest is going to be Ken Walsh. Ken has been with me a number of times on the show. He's an award-winning journalist. He serves as contributing White House analyst and has covered the White House for U.S. News and World Report since 1986. So that includes the presidencies of every president since Ronald Reagan. He's the author of at least 9 books. As I say, he's been on this show. This will be, I think, his 10th appearance. We'll be talking about current political conditions and what we can expect from the November elections and in 2024. That's 2 weeks from today, Saturday, October 22, 2022. Saturday, October 22, 2022, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Please use our PayPal links if you want to throw a few bucks our way. Help support the fine programming here on TalkRadio1.com. Our Amazon links and our eBay links, those don't cost you anything to use when you use them from the TalkRadio1.com homepage. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. Thank you so much for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. I am Stephen Spear. Throughout the country and around the world, this is TalkRadio1.com.